This message was presented at the DYC 2013 conference, Before Man and Angels, in Orlando, Florida. For other resources like this, visit us online at www.dycweb.org.
Have ever received advice from a counselor or a friend, someone that you should trust or normally would trust, and their kind of response is, I really do know what's going on. I know. There is no doubt about it. I've been told, you know, the Holy Spirit has whispered in my ear, I know what's going on in your life. There's no doubt. Yes. Comment. Yes, you're affirming. This has happened. This certainly can be one way that well-meaning elders, you know, deacons, elders in the church might come to you. Those who seem to have experience and wisdom, and you know, they're willing to lean heavily on that reputation as senior counselors and say, God, as you know, I really know what's going on with you, Job. They're laying it on thick. That's my point. Eliphaz lays it on with what I would call elderly thickness. You know, I really know what's going on, Job. You need to admit your error because of this inner insight that I have. And then in the second division, Eliphaz, Job chapter 5, he simply, you know, to summarize it, goes on to suggest that, you know, look, irrelevant of where I got it, surely, you know, just following basic common sense logic, Job, you can't play games with God. You know, this is, you know, as I said, an intense, special suffering of yours. And remember, God has all knowledge and power. So clearly, whether it's through my insight or through just your own reasoning, just recognize the inevitable, Job. You are suffering because of your sin. You are suffering because of what you have done. That is why you are in the circumstances that you are. So God has all knowledge and power, and remember that. That's important to note that the friends recognize that God has all knowledge and power, because that will be a theme that's returned to later on. So there's three basic questions, or sorry, not three, but here there's a basic question I want to ask. Is this biblical reasoning? Does it sound like, as I said, common sense, good biblical reasoning? And, well, the answer is, of course, a partial yes. You can definitely find biblical support. Be not deceived. God is not mocked. For whatsoever a man soweth, that shall he also reap. This is definitely biblical thinking that has been applied to Job. You know, you are suffering in a special way, and there's clearly, you know, cause and effect, common sense, orthodox thinking, orthodox theology. There's got to be a reason, Job. That is why you are suffering. So, but of course, I add a little sort of there, because there may be more to the picture than simply cause and effect involved in this situation. But it is a very strong, remember, the whole purpose of starting the way that I did was to exclude the prelude, to cut out the beginning, the prologue, to cut out what we know, to leave Job and his friends where they were without any special insight. So to really understand how you might really grapple with it. So here again is Job's three friends, his wife, and their theology. Job's reply in chapter 6 is, oh, that my vexation were weighed, and all my calamity laid in the balances, for then it would be heavier than the sand of the sea. Therefore, my words have been indeed rash, and he's here referencing back to his beginning, you know, that I wish I could die. Definitely, I have begun to, you know, question God. Definitely, I don't know what God is doing. And so Job acknowledges that he has been strong and emotional in his language. There's no doubt that Job admits that, you know, he is confused. He admits that he's been speaking very strongly. But to summarize it, if you were where I am, you'd understand my sorrow is so terrible that it gives me a justified, good reason to complain. Continuing to the responses, and again, I cannot read them all in their highly poetic language. It is worth trying to actually sit through and read Job in a long afternoon to try and reflect on how they reason it through and their poetic style. But Bildad, the bold one, remember, he's more blunt and straightforward. Job, how long will you say such things? Your words are a blustering wind. Does God pervert justice? Does the Almighty pervert what is right? When your children sinned against him, he gave them over to the penalty of their sin. Remember how yesterday I had mentioned that the children would come back into play. Remember, they died at the end of the first day of his suffering. And his friends, in their very considerate way, bring that to his mind. You know, they're trying to really, you know, poke him. Imagine if you've suffered a loss of a family member. And then you are suffering yourself, you know, due to other related, you know, circumstances. And your friend comes to you and says, you know, look, your family died because of their sin, and now you're on your near deathbed yourself, and you're going to die too if you don't take this opportunity to repent. If you don't take this chance, you're going to end where they did. You know, how would that come across? My goodness. That is rough language. But if you will look to God and plead with the Almighty, if you are pure and upright, even now he will rouse himself on your behalf and restore you to your rightful place. This is a temptation, my friends. This is a temptation. Understanding the story as you do, this is definitely a very strong appeal for Job to change his tune and think differently about what is happening. And the circumstances definitely warrant it. The circumstances definitely would seem to warrant it. The weight of the council of the elders has come down from the church, and this is what they say. They all claim to know and believe about God. They all know, claim inner insight, think through their reasoning as it spirals stronger and stronger. They are telling Job that they know what's going on, and they're giving him the path towards redemption. They're offering him a ticket to what they believe will restore him. But Job maintains, this is from a little bit earlier, but his tone remains, "Teach me and I would be silent and I will be silent. Make me understand how I have erred. How forceful are honest words. You've been honest with me. But what does reproof from you reprove? What does your reproof reprove? I can admit of nothing. I can admit of nothing. Yes, the suffering appears to be special. It appears to be singularly, you know, isolated and, you know, to me. And it appears that it has come through divine, you know, definitely through divine something, divine participation somehow. But, you know, what does your reproof reprove? Before this God that we all are maintaining a belief in, I know of nothing in me. I know of nothing that would warrant this." And as we'll note later, Job doesn't claim absolute lifetime perfection of any sort, but he is saying, I have lived a life of integrity to myself. When I have made mistakes, I have always repented of them. You know, as soon as I became aware of them, there is nothing in me that seems to warrant what is going on. This is too extreme. This is not fair. This is not just. According to all measures of you know, how justice should work. What does your reproof reprove? There is nothing in me. He says, I cannot. Here he is defending himself. You know, why me? Why me? You know, you guys are all lecturing me. You wag your fingers, but I cannot see it. I cannot see what you are asking me to do. Zophar's argument, just to jump ahead a little bit, they all do take their turns in their powerful, poetic ways. But we'll turn, in fact, the sequence of this one in chapter 20 comes after one of Job's strongest self-defenses, and we'll come back to that later. But Zophar continues to hammer him time after time. You know, again, this takes, you know, goes on for I don't know how long their conversations took place. And what else, you know, what other words may have been shared in their discussions with each other, their speeches. But Zophar continues, you know, imagine this, as I said, this is a later argument, just going to Zophar's later talks, but, you know, they just kind of continues to spiral and spiral. It just escalates. And Zophar describes the wicked as doing things that are clearly apparent. The evil comes out into the open. Obviously, Zophar suggests that because Job has gone through this time of torment, with these awful boils breaking out upon him, it is evident that his evil too is coming out into the open. As he shares in Job 20, utter darkness is hid up for the wicked. That is their treasure. The heavens will reveal his iniquity. There is no doubt that the wicked will not be able to hide what they have done. And the earth will rise up against the wicked ones. This is the wicked man's portion from God, the heritage decreed for him by God. This is, again, after Job has made multiple, at this point already, more than one, self-defense, saying, I just don't see it in me. I don't see anything worthy of what is happening. And Zophar hammers him. This is, you know, what you are in here, you know, what you are suffering through, what you are experiencing is the wicked man's portion. Don't think that you can hide from this obvious conclusion. That is, again, just a sample of Zophar's arguments. So I want to, again, kind of put together the three friends theology. And note that I think one of the benefits of this book is indeed not only to note the discussion of its great central theme found in the beginning, chapters 1, with kind of the prologue, the behind-the-curtain perspective, but I also think that the reason that the rest of this book does exist, and there isn't just one simple argument from each person, you know, Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar, but that it actually shows, and Moses was inspired by God to write it out in full, to see this spiraling escalation through these differing personalities, all reflecting the same theology. So it kind of, you know, there is more than one way to express the same flaw. That's really what I see here. And I think you can summarize it, as a few have done, as an early version. Of course, this is outside the covenant line. This is outside of Abraham, and long before there were any Pharisees. But it is kind of a Pharisaism, a legalism that you see expressed here, even though it comes, of course, much later. And what that always leans toward, what the Pharisees' attitude always leans toward, was a sort of orthodox, common-sense theology that was without true godliness. It can have an appearance of being correct at times, an overwhelming appearance, you know, of being correct at times. It definitely can appear to be true because it has elements of truth in it. And it can even include, as I note, you know, righteousness and outward behavior. But it actually represents a distortion of the truth. And this is very important to keep in mind. I want to give a summary of part two before I share a little setup for part three, where I will give a little bit more of Job's responses and thinking to what's going on. But it's what I see happening in the dialogues of Job and with his friends and their arguments is that in different ways, the three friends all insist that Job is somehow deserving of his suffering. And again, in different ways is important. So friends can come to us in different ways and through expressing all the varieties of human personalities and styles and perspectives, all through what I would call the common sense way of thinking. And yet they all can arrive at the same conclusion, a wrong one. Job's suffering is undoubtedly intense and unusual, and that's important because whenever you are actually experiencing something that has a special kind of intensity or seems to be truly standing out, such that it would warrant this kind of these attacks, you know, you're going to find this kind of questioning. This is natural. This is not just average suffering. This is not just the day-to-day suffering. This is not anything of that sort. This is not a cause and effect suffering of a direct sort. As I said, I take drugs and ruin my mind, and then I end up you know, living a life that was very different than the one before. But this is not like that. This is you know, seemingly unwarranted, coming from the outside, and is intense and unusual, making him especially prone. That's the point to emphasize, making him especially prone to his friends' attacks, because they're laying it on thick. They have the weight of the theology behind them. They claim insight into his situation, and that makes him especially prone to their attacks, given the nature of his suffering. They also importantly invoke God's power and knowledge, and this is, of course, true. Many of the friends, throughout their poetic attacks on Job, say have many isolated true statements. You can quote a lot of the friends and come up with a lot of correct theology. A lot of correct things are said about God dispersed throughout their poetic attacks on him. They say a lot of true things, and that's important to note. Nevertheless, Job resists this strongly, that it, by implication, all their true statements lead up to the fact that he has done something worthy of, you know, this special punishment. And the fact that he keeps resisting, keeps raising the stakes as the friends keep, cycling, circling, spinning, upward in their intensity of their critique on him. So the friends strengthen their attacks as Job, begins to defend himself. So again, that's why you can definitely see an evolving state of mind in Job from his initial, woe is me, to now wait a minute, woe is me, but he had this desire to defend himself because he could not acknowledge that he had done anything worthy of this. And of course, it is important to note that there is a logic to the three friends' arguments. Sometimes what they say is true. Sometimes it can be that special suffering is the response of God to as a judgment, and you will find biblical examples of that with other kinds of individuals when God does judge both individuals and people groups. So there can be a time when special suffering is a judgment of God, although he usually makes it more clear to the individual and does point them towards the right path. But again, in this circumstance, in this situation, you can imagine not knowing any other circumstances, not knowing God's perspective, that for Job himself, with his friends claiming insight into God's perspective, how intense his suffering really was at this point, even more than the health and wealth trials that he'd gone through earlier. The real trial of Job is not the fact that his health and wealth were taken away from him. It's the fact that he was accused of being deserving of losing his health and wealth, that he deserved to lose it because of something that he had done specifically wrong. That is why Job suffered the most. This is the intensity of his suffering. So what mattered to him more, clearly, I think, and the fact that he keeps defending himself means there is something that matters more. There is something that matters more to Job, and there is something that matters perhaps more to someone else than the fact that he has suffered the loss of health and wealth. There is something else. And again, I just noting that the friends all focus on, and this is very important to also remember, they focus on the externals of religion and life and not what is inside the heart. Although they are talking about what they think is inside Job's heart, they're focusing on the external consequences, apparent consequences. They're focusing on the outside to look inside. So they're viewing the inside through the lens of the outside and not the other way around or some other through some other method. I want to prepare you a little bit for tomorrow. Conclusion where I really do try and offer a new way of thinking about some of these questions on theodicy and trying to understand a little bit more about God's perspective and how we can relate it and understand it within a great controversy context. But I want to give a little bit of a word study for you and give an opportunity to stretch our minds in a little bit of a different way. And if you have your Bibles, I will make this portion a little bit participatory. And I would like to have a little bit of a word study opportunity. That's one of the privileges that those of us who spend some time at seminary or studying theology get to do, is to dig in a little bit to the Greek and the Hebrew and to try and glean some extra insight into the way that God chose to inspire the Bible. And sometimes you do learn some neat things. So I would actually like, if you have it, and we can take turns reading it, I'd like to hear from you a little bit, your voices. And I don't know, someone from over here, you can raise your hand. Someone choose Joshua 3:5 and read it. We'll take this gentleman in the front. And to someone on the left, and I won't read them all, but I just want to just demonstrate or establish the pattern. And someone from over here read Genesis 18:14. And then maybe we'll start, share just a couple of more, but... Sure. Joshua 3:5.
And Joshua said to the people, "Sanctify yourselves, for tomorrow the Lord will do wonders among you."
You remember the context of Joshua? As he was preparing the people for, part of the conquest. And what kind of wonders, that's the word we're looking at here, wonders or miracles is the translation. What kind of wonders are we expecting through this word? What would you call that? What happened because of Joshua's, request here and his appeal to the people? This is for that too. There are many wonders, and yes, the parting of the Jordan and the entire conquest. Yes. So what are we looking at? What kind of an event? A miracle. We're looking at what everyone would call a miracle, right? Exactly. We're looking at something that is definitely what you would call a physical miracle, right? A physical miracle, something that is really tangible. Genesis 18:14. Someone who, over here who has it? Anyone? Or has a Bible?
Is anything too hard for the Lord? At the time appointed, I will return unto thee according to the time of life. Sarah shall have a son.
All right. You remember the story of Sarah and Abram and their difficult child conception process? What does the angel of the Lord say to them? That at the appointed time, or what does he say? He says, is anything too hard for the Lord? Now, the Hebrew word in both of these two verses that we've just read is palah. That's the root there, palah. And it means a wonderful thing, depending on what translation you have in English. It means wonder. It means miracle. Is anything too difficult, for the Lord? Of course, what is that? That's a miracle. We call the birth of Isaac a miracle. Is anything too difficult for the Lord? You could go through the rest of these passages. In fact, let's read a couple more. I really want to get the pattern. Would someone read from over here as well that has a Bible, Psalms 106, verse 22. Does someone else have a Bible? Any volunteers? Or anyone, either side. Terrible things by the Red Sea. And what do you think of when you think back to the Red Sea? You think of deliverance, and you think of great physical miracles that helped deliver the people. Exactly so. Miracles. Exodus 3:20. Anyone else? Anyone? All right. You recall what God did for the people of Israel to the Egyptians. Do you remember the series of plagues, the 10 plagues that God used to deliver the people and to, tell Egypt that the people of God, the Hebrew people, were ready to be delivered? What would you call those 10 plagues? Would you call them just ordinary events, just random occurrences? No. We can't call them random occurrences. Those 10 plagues definitely represented what you would call a miracle. We would call these classical miracles in every sense of how we use the word. Let's read another one, Exodus 15:11, just again establishing the use of the word, the use Hebrew of the Hebrew word palah. Exodus 15:11, someone else. And doing wonders. When you read that verse, doing wonders. What are you thinking about? The God that works miracles, right? The God that works miracles. That cannot be explained. That's right. They cannot be easily explained. They are definitely interferences into the normal flow of cause and effect. In other words, you cannot trace a cause to this other than God. You cannot trace it as just the random flows. It's unfortunate that a lot of critics of the Bible today, we call them higher critics, historical critical scholars trying to reconstruct how the Bible was written, assuming that God did not write it. And unfortunately, this has even infected some versions of what we call liberal Christianity. In fact, to be perfectly honest with you, for your educational purposes, it has even infected some Seventh-day Adventists who are in our church ranks at various places. Who have begun to want to rebuild the Old Testament as a book without any miracles, as containing no miracles. And what they try and do is they try and trace all of the occurrences of wonders in the Old Testament as random, naturally caused events. You can look at, remember, when God gave, kind of against his original intentions, he didn't really want to do it, but when he gave them the birds, the quails to eat, you remember, and this was a miracle. It's described as a miracle, but some of these liberal Christians will try and say, that was just an ordinary bird flock that came by at the appropriate season, and it was all just completely natural. God had nothing to do with it. The parting of the Red Sea, they even go so far as to try and explain that one away as some sort of wind or something natural, something totally natural. There was no God involvement at all. There was no wonder. There was no divine wonder going on here. There was no physical miracle that was outside of the natural order of cause and effect. And I could go through the rest of these verses, and many of them are references back, like from the Psalms, 86, 96, and 77, 78. They're referencing back to Egypt, because throughout the rest of the Old Testament, there is something that's very consistent, and that is the importance of the Israelites' early history. And so you'll see repeated references back to the Red Sea and Egypt and the plagues throughout the Psalms, and they all call them. These are all occurrences. These verses all have for the whatever the English word may be in that situation or that that verse or your translation, but it's all the same Hebrew word, the same Hebrew word. So you can detect the pattern of how the biblical writers were choosing their words, and they're all wonders, miracles, difficult things, things of that nature, and all of them over 70 times that this word occurs in the Old Testament, it always means, in these, except for a couple of exceptions, it always means a physical miracle. It always means something like the Red Sea. It always means something powerful, like the birth of a child that just could not happen, without divine intervention. It could not happen without a miracle, and or a wonder. The English word again, wonderful things. As I'll note, I chose because I did borrow this from some other contexts in which I've shared this, the Egyptian ancient history thing, although it ties into Job's time period as well, because the Egyptian kingdom, although not for Tutankhamun here, but Egypt was already rising as a power during these times. Before Moses wrote it, Egypt was already beginning to rise. And in a world without miracles, I just want to note that there is always greed and selfish ambition. What is the most wonderful thing for the atheist secular mind? And it is no doubt going to be wealth, health and wealth, right? That's what's the most important thing is health and wealth. That's what's wonderful about life. That's the miracle of the atheist's life is health and wealth. If you have taken away God out of your life, the miracle of life, the wonderful things, the pala of life for the atheist is health and wealth. And I think that the Egyptians, pharaohs, definitely enjoyed some of that. You can enjoy their rather lavish lifestyle for their situation, life, and context. I don't think most of us have burial chambers prepared for us that look like this, that are covered with gold, and we were so highly revered during our lives, even if they were short, like this boy king, Tutankhamun. But these represent the atheists' wonders of the world. And since I come from, again, my choice of choosing this kind of archaeological connection is I do come from that background, I have enjoyed seeing these all in person. And it is very impressive to witness the wealth of the ancient world and the wonders of their lifestyle. And this is Moses' world, just giving you a quick insight into, as I mentioned last time, the author of Job. This is the world that he would have seen, the wonders of his world. As an example, these Tutankhamun is later and after Moses' time, but still it is interesting to see some of the sample wealth of the English world sitting on the throne. It kind of changes your mindset about life when you sit down on that chair every day, doesn't it? I always wondered about that. For all royalty, just as a little footnote, I have to note that whenever you have been to the palaces in France or anywhere else, Versailles, you go to these places and you go into their bedrooms covered with gold, walls, and you wonder, would I think about myself differently if I woke up there, I always wonder about that, the ego thing. But, that ties into the Job situation, because do you think about yourself differently depending on the circumstances of how you woke up, how your health and wealth are lined up? When you wake up and you see this waiting for you, to come sit down here, you're going to think of yourself as rather blessed. Clearly, you're living the good life. God has divinely blessed you, and so therefore you are royal, and God has ordained this, and thus and thus. And that's kind of the opposite of Job. That's why this ties in nicely. This is the opposite. If you're sitting here, you're going to be thinking the opposite of what Job is friends, as Job was feeling. However, I have to note that on the health and wealth footnote, was Tutankhamun impressed at his being discovered? No. Why? Why was he not impressed? Because he was dead. You know, there is no Tutankhamun to enjoy being discovered. And at the wonders, there's the neat story of when his tomb was discovered. Howard Carter, when they had first, you know, broken through and they were peeling back the unopened, unrobbed. Remember, most of the Egyptian tombs have been plundered in antiquity, meaning after they were buried. But in the intermediate time between modern times, you know, various robbers and burglars have gone in and stolen it, despite the curses that they placed over their over their tombs. But it's neat because when they first discovered it, and his you know, workers were trying to, you know, break through, and they had a flashlight, you know, there, and they were looking in back you know, many years ago, this century, last century. But when they first looked in, the archaeologist said, you know, Howard Carter was kind of behind them. You know, he had his front man there actually breaking through, the pickaxe man, and those that actually do the real work, not the chief men. But he asked him, "What do you see? What do you see?" You know, they've broken into this unopened tomb. And the words from his worker were, "I see wonderful things. I see wonderful things." So I see, you know, miracles, the atheist, the archaeologist miracle. I see wonderful things. So they had found, again, the dream of any worldly person. They had found the wonders. They had found the wealth. They had made their careers as archaeologists and would enjoy it forever.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You look at them and they say, wow.
Yep. Right.
You know, it's no
comparison. That's not lasting. Yep. Yeah. That is lasting. And we'll come to why that is so important. We will continue to remind ourselves of that. But exactly, this is the worldly person's, the atheist's miracle, so just to put it in context for some people. But there is one more kind of Pilah, over 72 occurrences of the Hebrew word Pilah. However, there are about three or four exceptions that do not follow the normal mold. That's a pretty small minority. We're talking, you know, around 5% of the occurrences that don't follow the normal mold of how the word is used, which is always Red Sea, the birth of a child that could not be born otherwise. Miracles, okay? The Pilah always means a wonder, a divine wonder. But there is one exception, one special exception that is worth dwelling upon that will help, I think, connect us tomorrow to common sense and theology and theodicy. Psalms 119, verses 15 to 20 for the full context. The psalmist says, "I will meditate on thy precepts and regard thy ways. I shall delight in thy statutes. I shall not forget thy word. Deal bountifully with thy servant, that I may live and keep thy word. Open my eyes, that I may behold Pilah, things from thy law, that I may behold miracles from your law." Miracles from your law. "I am a stranger in the earth. Do not hide thy commandments from me. My soul is crushed with longing after thine ordinances at all times." At all times. I hope the meaning and significance of this exception to the inspired writer's use of this special word, Pilah, can begin to sprinkle through, you know, percolate through your minds on why God would choose to call his law as the container of miracles. Have you ever thought about that? That God's law is the box. You see the Ark of the Covenant with the Ten Commandments inside, and what is inside is a miracle. What is inside the box is a miracle. Think about that. "For it is God which worketh in you to both to will and to do of his good pleasure." Let's take this miracle context a little bit further. The miracle working power of Christ's grace is revealed in the creation in man of a new heart, a higher life, a holier enthusiasm. God says, "A new heart also will I give you." Ezekiel 36:26. "Is not this the renewal of man, the greatest miracle that can be performed? What cannot the human agent do who by faith takes hold of the divine power?" Human effort avails nothing without divine power, and without human endeavor, divine effort is with many of no avail. There's a two-way relationship. Continuing, these are Ellen White quotations. As you may know, this is from Acts of the Apostles. The profane have become reverent, the drunken sober, the profligate pure. Souls that have borne the likeness of Satan have been transformed into the image of God. This change is in itself the miracle of miracles. A change wrought by the Word, it is one of the deepest mysteries of the Word. We cannot understand it. We can only believe. As declared by the Scriptures, it is Christ in you, the hope of glory. I had to collect them because they're so powerful. Christ's love in the heart revealing through the life its wondrous power. This is the greatest miracle that can be performed before a fallen, quarreling world. Think back to Joshua's question, you know, and reminder to the people of Israel. Prepare yourselves. In fact, but prior to that, if you may recall, that remember Joshua, in fact, actually, I didn't read that one, but Gideon, I didn't read that verse. Apologies for that. But in Judges, Gideon also has the question, you know, when there has been a time of silence prior to the deliverance of the people and their coming in to the promised land, but they've been oppressed. And Gideon wonders, you know, he asks, where are the miracles of our fathers? He asks that exact question, where are the palah of our fathers? We are now, as the people of Israel, we are now, you know, living in down times and down circumstances, and where are the miracles of our fathers? And so just keep in mind that this question is a common one to the Christian mind. Gideon asked it, and many others of us, I think we all can ask this question. Where are the miracles of our fathers? Where we're looking for too often, looking to, you know, for the Red Sea. I want a Red Sea parting in my life. Then I will understand that God is at work. Then I will understand what God's miracles are about when I have a Red Sea parting, when I have some other kind of physical miracle. But we are reminded through this exception of the use and Ellen White's understanding or her, you know, comments on the general reaction to this exception that this is a wondrous power. This is the greatest miracle that can be performed before a fallen, quarreling world. Let us try to work this miracle. That's right. You are called to be miracle workers. Did you know that? You are all called. There is no exceptions. There is no exception to the Christians. You are all called to be miracle workers. Let us try to work this miracle, not in our own power, but in the name of the Lord Jesus Christ, whose we are and whom we serve. Let us put on Christ, and the miracle-working power of His grace will be so plainly revealed in the transformation of character that the world will be convinced that God has sent His Son into the world to make men as angels. You know, I was reflecting on our theme here, you know, before men and angels. But what are we actually asked to do? To make men as angels in character and life. Some may say, if we believe the Bible, continuing from Spirit of Prophecy, why does not the Lord work miracles for us? This was exactly Gideon's question. He will, if we will let Him, when a human mind is allowed to come, and I love this quote when I found it, because I remember yesterday, if you were here for the part one, the second time repeating part one, I talked about the context of psychology and psychiatry and neuroscience and how common sense is leading us into some paradoxes and contradictions on how to understand human free will and the laws of biochemistry in our mind, and how psychiatry as a discipline is crumbling because of this pressure. But listen to this. He will, if we will let Him, when a human mind is allowed to come under the control of God, that mind will reveal the miracle-working power of God. The power of the mind in action is like the miracle-working power of God. That is Ellen White. The power of the mind in action is like the miracle-working power of God. That is amazing. That is unbelievable. That is unbelievable. That's right. When your mind is working and God is with you and you are working with God, that is a miracle. The mind working is a miracle by definition of what a miracle is. Unbelievers have inquired, why are not miracles wrought among those who claim to be God's people? Brethren, the greatest miracle that can be wrought is the conversion of the human heart. We need to be reconverted, losing sight of self and human ideas and beholding Christ, that we may be transformed into His likeness. When this, the greatest of all miracles, is wrought within our hearts, we shall see the working of other miracles. One more as we close here, a couple minutes, and then now we can open for a few comments or questions. God cannot work through us miraculously while we are unconverted. It would spoil us, for we would take it as an evidence that we were perfect before Him. Our first work is to become perfect in His sight by living faith, claiming the promise of His forgiveness. Ask what ye will. This is for the broader context. Not Job, by the way, in the special sense, but Christ declared to His disciples, "And it shall be done unto you." I'm going to end there with that thought and keep that in mind, that we need to redefine our understanding of miracles outside of the normal way that we think about the cause and effect relationships in the world. And this will tie in very directly to how Job should be understood and how the climax of Job and how it relates to the great controversy really comes together. And I'll share that tomorrow for Sabbath. We'll call it the Sabbath afternoon session. And I will begin to try and tie together new ways of thinking about some of these very difficult questions of human suffering and what really mattered to God, what the real test is for Job, and what the real test is for all of us as we struggle through the health and wealth and other struggles and circumstances that life may share for us. Are there any comments or anything of that sort, questions or anything else? I will open it for you. We have a couple of minutes before the session concludes. Yes?
Mm-hmm. Going back to the topic of trying to read a book from the Old Testament, I remember a story told to me, and maybe it's not the original story, of a professor, the only professor, who had to, for some special circumstances, teach a Bible class to children. Mm-hmm. He was trying to explain them that, you know, when they cross the Red Sea, they actually cross the low parts of the Red Sea.
Yes.
And then there is a kid in the back of the class.
A path that was not available to the followers, huh? Apparently. All right.
The
Egyptians. I've heard that too. You know, I don't want to deny, just to be clear, that God can't work in seemingly invisible or transparent ways that may not always be manifestly a miracle. Of course, God can work in any way that He wants. But that would be quite a miracle to drown all the Egyptians in 2 feet of water in their chariots riding up high. But, you know, if God wanted to do it that way, I wouldn't complain, although I don't think He did. Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Right. You don't. That's a lesson. That is a good lesson. We need to be very careful. Thank you for that story. Any other comments? Yes. There are some lessons to that. I'll return to them a little bit next time in part three because I will include a little bit of Job's attitude and how far he really does go. You know, he goes all the way to the edge. I mean, he's standing on the precipice and accuses God of being too involved, you know, in the wrong way. And we'll see that. And that's Jesus. You know, Jesus is the Job, no doubt about it. Jesus experienced the Jobian suffering. So he is the example. Yes?
Sorry, I missed the other presentations, but what you touched on with free will, mm-hmm. I'm wondering your thoughts on that, if free will But then how the Bible says, you know, we're saved by grace and everything, it almost seems as though we have no free will until God, by his grace, allows us to choose. I'm just kind of wondering about
that. Yeah, those are great questions. I don't think that we have absolute or clear answers that can be given. Obviously, I do believe that that human beings do have freedom given to them, but there is a desire amongst most to always try and reduce or simplify into absolute freedom, what is often called like enlightenment or autonomous freedom, where the human being is totally and wholly in control, and the body is kind of just this thing, you know, that is there and separate and so forth, and the mind-body relationship is kind of severed or taken to be so distant that there's really no connection. On the other hand, if you do accept a more of a mind-body relationship, which I think is the Adventist position, a close relationship between mind and body, that's why health is so important to us, the health message, they will begin to come together. But that doesn't mean that law-orderedness is ultimately, as we understand typical law-orderedness, as I said, simple cause and effect, that there isn't still going to be a problem there. And understanding the role of the Holy Spirit in the human mind, in the unbeliever and in the believer, is very complex. I do think that true freedom, real freedom, only comes for the one who is believing in God, meaning authentic freedom. And I'll talk a little bit more about that next time and what real authentic freedom is about, because that's related to the great controversy theme and what real freedom really is. But of course, there is a limited or secondary freedom that is granted to the sinner, or the one who is, either knowingly or willingly or unknowingly living, in violation of, the laws of God. They still do have some kind of freedom. However, is it more of a freedom of the will that they are given to choose between certain, as God, presents them in their life with, opportunities to follow greater light, versus simply a freedom to enjoy, and like what they want. In other words, the sinful desires that we are all born with are not part of our freedom. We are slaves. We are slaves to sin. We are not autonomously free. That must be rejected. It's more of a very paradoxical gradient of what kinds of freedom and how the Holy Spirit is directed. There are no easy answers. And I'm not going to pretend that there are, but they are offered, and I think that we should reject all the easy solutions. It's very complicated, but I do believe in freedom. Yes. Any other?
Mm-hmm. When you talk about the sex and ethical position, the medical community believes that they can set people free by using a medication.
That's right. That's right. Drugs are freedom in this case.
Right. And they're pushing these medications. Like
That's right. And sometimes they seem to help.
Yeah. What is happening is, in the last days, if these people are not given the choice that Jesus is the only one who can free them mentally, and the health messages, a powerful tool,
right,
they will not be free.
That's right.
And
they will not be free. Note that your comment and the mind-body relationship and the context of Job and what is really going on in the health and wealth versus the moral dimension that will be talked about more in the next time, but that there are different levels of freedom. There is what we would call just a simple, physical freedoms, and freedom, by the way, is such a huge topic. Political freedom, all kinds of understandings of what freedom is: positive freedom, negative freedom, the freedom to do what I want, the freedom, so forth. So there's lots of different kinds of freedom, but there are two major ones that have been highlighted, and that is what we would call a clear mind freedom. And a clear mind freedom, the health message, is not the same thing as moral freedom. Once you have embraced the law and are understanding and are living your life in harmony with God's law, that is a new kind of freedom that is different from simply using the health message or using the occasional and cautious, because I have a cautious approach towards psychiatry and those medicines. There's a lot of harm there, but on occasion, I don't want to say 100% bad. I think we shouldn't take these absolutes that we usually try to in our human minds, simplify everything. I like to take a little bit more of a complex picture, but that kind of freedom, no matter how you slice and dice the issue of the mind and the mind-body freedom and the health message, is a little bit different than the moral dimension. And so the health and wealth part of freedom, and you can see that as kind of political freedom, wealth, or the desire to do what we want and live our lives the way that we want, and the health are the actual mind and how it's free to think and do, what it wants to do, are separate dimensions of the moral freedom, which is another part of the picture, and a very important one. We'll see you next time.
This message was recorded by Fountain View Productions for GYC. GYC, a supporting ministry of the Seventh-day Adventist Church, seeks to inspire and equip young people to be vibrant, Bible-based, and Christ-centered Christians. To download or purchase other resources like this, please visit us online at www.gycweb.org.